The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, why we shouldn't always listen to what our brain is telling us.
Within the United States, where we have the death penalty, a number of people have been convicted and sentenced to death and later exonerated by DNA testing. And in the vast majority of those cases, people were convicted on the basis of confident testimony of a witness who placed them at the scene of the crime.
We look at what's going on inside our heads and why our intuition is deceiving us.
When he was arrested, he was astonished that he was on the video surveillance tapes because, as he put it, he had worn the juice. He'd rubbed lemon juice on his face, thinking that that would make him invisible to security cameras.
Believe it or not, only now, 40 years on, have the sound and pictures of some parts of the moon landing been finally put together.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
And why comics are finally putting patients in the picture.
Comics give the opportunity to, explore sort of the left brain and the right brain and sort of mine both sides for insight into an experience. And the words can access one thing, but when you challenge yourself to make images, you're accessing something totally different. And it's very powerful to put those two things together.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back, everyone. Now, before we start, a bit of a public service message. This is admittedly an unusual way to start a podcast, but you may be in front of a computer or get the internet on your phone or MP3 player. Basically, we want you to stop listening, just for a few moments. This initial section will work much better if you watch a particular YouTube clip first. It's 90 seconds long, and the link is on our blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly, or you can Google selective attention test. So, pause right now and come back for the explanation. Though if you can't be bothered, this podcast will still work without seeing the clip. Have you found it yet? Come on. Okay, so you've had your chance to stop. Let's get this show on the road. Our brains are constantly playing unbelievable yet routine tricks on us. Understanding them can teach us how we perceive the world and what we get wrong. To explain more, we can cross to a studio in Illinois, where the author of a new book called The Invisible Gorilla is waiting for us. His name is Daniel Simons. Daniel, welcome. Can you just run us through this famous gorilla experiment?
The study that inspired the name of our book, The Invisible Gorilla, was actually one that Chris Chabris and I did about a dozen years ago now. And it was based on some much earlier work by our colleague Ulrich Neisser from the 1970s. And it's a fairly simple study. We had people watch a video in which three people were wearing white shirts and passing a basketball. And their only task was to count how many times the players passed the ball. We made it a little harder by having the players fake some passes and move around each other and bounce the ball, dribble it. We also had three people wearing black shirts passing their own ball. But you were only supposed to count how many times the players wearing white passed the ball. And after some time, about halfway through the video, we had a person wearing a full-body gorilla suit walk into the scene, get to the middle of the scene and turn to face the camera, thump its chest, and then walk off the other side a total of about 9 seconds later. And what we found was that when people were busy counting the passes by the players wearing white, about half of the people didn't see the gorilla at all. And when we showed it to them later, they were shocked. They sometimes accused us of rewinding the tape, tells you how old the study is, or of switching the video that we showed them. It's surprising to people because we have the strong intuition that if something unexpected and distinctive happens right in front of us, we'll automatically notice it. People who saw the gorilla couldn't believe that anyone would miss it, and people who miss it were shocked that they didn't see it because it's so counterintuitive to them.
And so what does this say about the way that our brains process the world around us?
Well, several things. So one thing it shows us is that we don't actually see as much of the world as we think we see. So we're very good at focusing attention on a limited aspect of the world. We focus our attention on a few things that we want to see, and the result of that is we have to filter out some things that we don't care about. And unfortunately, we sometimes also filter out things that we might care about. That's a phenomenon known as inattentional blindness. It's a mouthful of a name, but basically the idea is if you're not focusing attention on something, you often don't consciously perceive it. What's interesting from my perspective and from the perspective of our book is that our intuitions about this sort of failure of awareness are wrong. We've known about these sorts of failures of awareness for years, But what's interesting about this is if you make it such a vivid thing that people are astonished that they could miss it, it reveals what we intuitively believe we see as opposed to what we actually see. It reveals that we think we're going to notice anything important that happens in front of us, and the reality is we actually don't much of the time. Things don't grab our attention.
I mean, from an evolutionary point of view, does this make sense to not notice, say, a predator right in front of you?
Well, it might or it might not. I'm not an evolutionary psychologist, but I can tell a little bit of a story about why this might make sense. If you think about what sort of resources it would take to notice everything in our environment while at the same time being able to focus attention intently on the things that we care about, it would take a tremendous amount of resources. We need to be able to focus on what matters and not necessarily on things that are distracting. We don't care if there are leaves blowing in the distance if what we're focused on is, you know, an animal in the scene. So there's some reason to think it makes sense to build a system that uses focused attention this way. But if you also think about it, evolutionarily, it was a much simpler time. You're moving at pedestrian speeds. You're often around other people who might notice things. And if you don't spot something for a few seconds, it's really not in the matter most of the time. Whereas if you're driving at 100 kilometers an hour and somebody walks out into the street, it really matters if you don't notice it for even a fraction of a second. It can mean the difference between life and death.
And so what does this say about our memories, witness statements in court from your average Joe?
The legal system, both in the UK and in the US, is based on intuitions about how the mind worked that date back hundreds, possibly thousands of years. There's an intuition that the best evidence you can provide is an eyewitness to the event who points to the accused and says, that's the person who did it. And the reality is, as we know from the last 30 or 40 years of research on eyewitness memories, that eyewitness memory is fallible. We tend to believe when we recall something vividly that it must be accurate. But the reality is that it often isn't. It's often distorted. And you can actually fail to see something that's right there in front of you.
So how do we use this information? I mean, if we're saying that witness testimony, for example, or is not really very reliable, I mean, again, people have said this before, how do we use the research that you're talking about in your book to, you know, improve the uses of memory and observation in these sorts of situations?
Well, I think there are a lot of things we can do. People have been working on this much longer than I have. People like Elizabeth Loftus are probably the best known for showing that memories can become distorted over time. The court system is finally starting to catch up to this a little bit. It's starting to recognize that eyewitnesses aren't always perfectly accurate, and just because somebody confidently says that they remember something doesn't mean that they're any more accurate. Confidence in many ways is a personality trait. But there are a couple of things we can do to look at this. One is that there's an over-reliance on eyewitnesses and an under-reliance on circumstantial evidence. And circumstantial evidence has gotten kind of a bad name in the court system. But if you think about it, if you have enough circumstances that all converge to the same conclusion, that's going to be a much better conclusion than one eyewitness saying, yeah, that's the guy I saw, when we know that eyewitnesses are fallible. So one thing you can do is rely more on circumstantial evidence than on witnesses themselves. I would much more take DNA evidence than a single witness, or even a couple of witnesses. And in fact, if you look within the United States where we have the death penalty, a number of people have been convicted and sentenced to death and later exonerated by DNA testing. And in the vast majority of those cases, the people were convicted on the basis of confident testimony of a witness who placed them at the scene of the crime.
Okay, well, let's go through some other examples of this sort of work in your book. You talk about films and how they're full of editing mistakes. Can you just take us through that?
Sure. So this is everybody's kind of experienced this. You've probably all at some point in your life spotted an error in a movie. So somebody's wearing a jacket and then they're not, or they're eating a pastry and then they're eating a pancake. These sorts of errors creep into movies all the time because of the way movies are created. They're filmed over many, many days out of sequence and cut together later in the editing room. And sometimes the best performance has a mistake in it and the editors want to keep it in there because it was the best performance and that was more important. What's interesting is I've often had people come into the lab and say, oh, I'm great at noticing those errors. I always spot them. And I know they're wrong because I can sit them down in front of a one-minute movie that Dan Levin and I made that has 9 intentional errors in it, and they don't spot any of them. Why do we have this intuition that we spot all of them? Well, it's a lot like the gorilla case. We only notice those things that we're only aware of those things that we've noticed, and we're not aware of all the ones we've missed. So if you spot a continuity error in a movie that's notable to you, you'll remember that you noticed it, you won't remember all the ones you never saw. So people then tend to generalize from the cases they're aware of and assume that they notice all of them.
So this is a case of confirmation bias.
In many ways, it's like a confirmation bias. It's basically detecting a pattern, but you're only getting half the evidence, or less than half the evidence. You're only getting evidence of the cases that you noticed, and you don't really think automatically, hey, I wonder if there are some that I'm missing. And that's one of the reasons that I think the gorilla video and some of the videos where we have changes and point them out to people are so striking to people. It counters that intuition. We by default, don't think about the cases that we might be missing. And the one group of people who do, and this is a really interesting tidbit, we interviewed a couple of people who are script supervisors. So they're the people who are on the sets of major movies, and their primary responsibility, among many other things, is to keep track of all of those details from one shot to the next to make sure everything's the same and that there aren't any of these errors creeping in. And they have a really difficult job. And you'd think, okay, these are people who spend their careers spotting changes. You think maybe they'd be great at it, that they'd automatically notice these changes. And they don't. What they'll say is, yeah, my visual memory might be a little better than, you know, the average person. But what they recognize and what we don't is that their memory is fallible. So they know they can't trust their memory to recall all of the details of the scene, and they have to rely on every prop and crutch they can come up with, videos and still images and anything else they can use to match up the scenes from one shot to the next.
It almost seems like a slightly Sisyphean task, this. You can never notice all the things that you want to notice.
That's right.
By definition, you can't possibly realize you're missing the things you're missing.
That's right. I mean, you really can't notice everything around you because we have limits in how much we can focus attention on. We have limits in how precisely we can store information. That said, we tend to notice what matters. So our brains are really built to extract the meaning from a scene and to make sense of what's going on in a scene. And that's really, in many cases, all that we really need to know. It's really rare that we have to spot these sorts of unexpected changes, especially in movies. It doesn't really matter. And as what the script supervisors say is, if you're spending all your time spotting errors in movies, that means the movie makers didn't do a good job of making the movie engaging so that you'd be focused on what mattered.
Can you tell me, this is intriguing, why criminals are, what they have in common with chess masters?
Sure, yeah. So this is what we call in our book the illusion of confidence. And there are several aspects to the illusion of confidence. One applies to eyewitnesses in courts. We tend to trust a confident witness more than a non-confident witness, even if we can't really tell whether that confidence corresponds to their accuracy or whether they're just confident people. But another aspect of confidence is that all of us tend to be somewhat overconfident of our abilities. And the critical aspect of this, as my colleagues Dave Dunning and Justin Kruger have shown, is that the people who are the least skilled and the least competent tend to be the most overconfident. They tend to be the most positive about their own abilities. So in the case of criminals, the really competent criminals don't tend to get caught. It's the ones who are kind of stupid. So the people who decide to vandalize a building by spray painting their name on it. Or we talk about the case that Dunning and Kruger discuss, which is of a guy named MacArthur Wheeler who robbed three banks in broad daylight with no disguise. And you think, okay, well, you have to be not very bright to do that. But you have to be confident enough to think that you're going to get away with it. And when he was arrested, because surveillance tapes were shown on the news and he was caught a few hours later, when he was arrested, he was astonished that he was on the video surveillance tapes because, as he put it, he had worn the juice. He'd rubbed lemon juice on his face thinking that would make him invisible to security cameras, right? So here's somebody who's clearly incompetent as a bank robber, but must think that he's good enough to do it. Now, chess players are a different breed altogether, right? These are people who are generally smarter. And Chris Chabris, my co-author, and a colleague Dan Benjamin and I did some studies with tournament chess players, competitive chess players, and we asked them two questions. The first was, what is your rating? And that's something that all chess players know. Chess has a really formal rating system that tells you exactly how good you are compared to your peers. It predicts with perfect precision, it's perfectly calibrated, how likely you are to beat somebody with your own rating or with other ratings. So it's a perfect predictor of skill. We asked them what their own rating was, and they knew that perfectly because it's printed next to their name at every tournament. We also asked them, what do you think your rating should be to reflect your true playing ability or skill? And on average, the players estimated that they were 100 points underrated. They thought they were 100 rating points better than they actually were, which is a huge amount. It means that they expected that they should beat somebody of their own skill 2/3 of the time. They massively inflate their ability, and it was the worst chess players, and these are still tournament chess players, but the worst among them were even more likely to overrate their abilities. They thought they were 150 points underrated.
So when someone finishes reading your book, they're probably going to think their memory's not as good as it can be, that they don't notice most things, they're probably a bit overconfident about certain things. Now, you might get a bit worried about this, about how your brain sort of sees the world, but do you have any positive messages for them to take from the book?
Sure. I mean, I actually think that there's a much more positive story to tell here. So we're pointing out a lot of limits that we have on our cognitive abilities. But the thing to remember is that those limits have been there all along, and just because you were unaware of them doesn't mean that they weren't there. So they've been affecting you daily all the time. But by pointing them out, you can actually take proactive steps to avoid their effects. So, for example, if you realize that unexpected events aren't automatically going to grab your attention, you won't say talk on a cell phone while you're driving, because that will diminish your chances of noticing something unexpected. And you'll put your cell phone away and turn it off and put it in the back seat so you won't be tempted. If you are on a jury and you're aware that memory is fallible and that eyewitnesses, just because they're confident, aren't necessarily accurate, you might discount the witness a little bit and be a little more trusting of circumstantial evidence. And that might lead to fewer false convictions. So there are a lot of positives that can come from this. One of the other aspects of confidence that I haven't talked about is that people who tend to speak first in a meeting are judged to be the leader of the group, regardless of whether they're actually the most capable. And if you know that and you're in a group discussion and the person who seems to be taking charge, you can discount them a little bit and say, okay, well, they're just a confident person. I wonder if somebody else in this room who isn't as confident might be more competent. So I think there are a lot of positives you can take away from this if you look to see how you can become aware of these limitations and compensate for them.
Daniel Simons there. You can check out lots of other fascinating videos on the book's website. That's at theinvisiblegorilla.com. Look for the Monkey Business Illusion video in particular.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
30 feet down, 2.5. Picking up some dust. 30 feet, 2.5 down. Great shadow.
Stand by for 30.
Four forward, drift into the right a little.
30 seconds.
A British filmmaker and space fan has restored sound to the famous film of NASA's Mission Control Room during the Apollo 11 moon landing.
Okay, engine stop. APA at a descent. Mode control both auto. Descent engine command override off. Engine arm off. 413 is in.
When Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon on the 20th of July 1969, NASA used two cameramen at Mission Control in Houston to capture the moment back on Earth.
We've had shutdown.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Okay, everybody, T1, stand by for T1.
But the famous footage has always lacked a synchronized soundtrack.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're looking good here.
Okay, we're going to be busy for a minute. I'll get this back.
Flight controller is about 45 seconds to T1. Stay, no stay.
Flight, that scene plus two looks beautiful.
Roger.
Apollo aficionado Stephen Slater has painstakingly reunited the visual material with the high-quality recordings of the original mission audio.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
You can see the synchronized video at guardian.co.uk/video. There's also a link there for the full 8 minutes at footagevault.com.
Stay. Control.
Stay.
Telcom.
Stay.
GNC.
Stay.
Ecom.
Stay.
Surgeon.
Stay.
Capcom, or stay for T1.
Hey, it looks like we're vending the oxidizer enough.
Roger, Eagle, and you are stay
right,
for
control,
T1.
Go
over.
Control.
Eagle,
we're
you are stay
ox.
For T1.
Betting on.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Doctors, nurses, and patients are increasingly using graphic art to unpack their experience of medicine and disease. Kieran O'Looney went to the first ever academic conference on the subject of comics and medicine at the University of London.
My name is Ian Williams. I'm the chair of the organising committee for comics and medicine, medical narrative in graphic novels. Until a few weeks ago, I was a GP in North Wales, working part-time. I've also worked for the past 12 years as a painter and printmaker. And over the past few years, I've also been a comics artist, working under a pseudonym. Comics have constantly had to battle against the stigma of being associated with juvenile mentality. There are many unfortunate stereotypes associated with comic book readers, but there's a long history of comic books being written for adult readers. The right back when comics began, you know, over 100 years ago, the envisaged readers were adults rather than children. Then somewhere along the line, they've been kind of hijacked by the kind of people writing for teens and adolescents or children, and that has kind of stuck. But there was a watershed in the 1980s, really, when serious, long graphic novels started being produced, which have had great critical acclaim. And over the last 10 years, graphic novels have been reviewed in broadsheet newspapers, in academic journals, and now there's a huge cohort of comics scholars who are looking at all forms of graphic narrative.
I'm talking to Michael Green, who teaches comics and medicine at Penn State Medical School. Comics and medicine, that's quite a strange mix.
Yeah, it seems like it is a strange mix. I've been doing this for the past 2 years, and it grew out of my own fascination with comics and and my wondering whether it was relevant to medical school and whether it could be integrated into medical education. And I think some of the things that students can learn through this include things about the doctor-patient relationship, communication of bad news, truth-telling, informed consent, empathy, the experience of illness from a patient's perspective, point of view. There's all sorts of themes that are quite relevant to being a good doctor, which one can see graphically depicted in these various sorts of books.
So does making a comic make you a better doctor?
Well, I hope it does. I think there are some translatable skills. I think the students say that they learn things that they wouldn't have otherwise known. They find it relevant. And some students have commented that they think they'll be a better doctor as a result. I think time will tell whether that turns out to be the case. It's certainly not going to make them worse doctors.
Hi, I'm MK, and I'm a nurse, and I make comics. We did an exercise that in which we asked the students to draw a diagnosis as if they are a patient receiving it, and then we also asked them to draw a different diagnosis as if they are a doctor giving it. And fascinatingly enough, when we looked at all these drawings, when they drew as a doctor, they tended to draw disembodied body parts. But when they drew as a patient, they drew an embodied experience of illness with reference to an emotional reaction and reference to their whole families and their lives, and we compared those.
Why use comics to tell medical narratives?
I think comics give the opportunity to, explore sort of the left brain and the right brain and sort of mine both sides for insight into an experience. And the words can access one thing, but when you challenge yourself to make images, you're accessing something totally different. And it's very powerful to put those two things together.
Hello, I'm Paul Gravett, and I am a researcher and historian and also a promoter of comics. I look into the past, but I also am very interested in the future, where this medium is going. And in terms of its dialogue with medical matters, comics on that subject go back a long way.
Well, we've been seeing more and more comics on medical themes in recent years, partly perhaps because of the ease of publishing on the web. Mm. Do you think this has made a big difference to the genre?
Definitely. We've seen this with both Brian Fee's Mum's Cancer and with Psychiatric Tales from Daryl Cunningham, both finding an audience first off and finding a huge response by being posted on the net.
Well, I'm talking to Brian Fee's, who's the creator of Mom's Cancer, an Eisner Award winning comic about his mother's battle with lung cancer. Tell us a little bit about when you first decided to write the comic. What was the inspiration behind it?
Well, my first thought was I wanted to share my family's story I thought of it as drawing a map so that other people following behind us and having similar experiences would know what to expect. And so that was my primary motivation. I thought about doing as perhaps a magazine article or a book. I didn't know. I'm a writer is my day job. And finally decided to do it as a graphic novel, as a comic, when I accompanied my mother to chemotherapy one day and drew a little sketch of her in the chair getting her chemotherapy, and decided that in that one sketch I'd somehow captured something essential to that day and that moment that I wouldn't have been able to any other way. Something about the combination of one picture with a few words told more than either a picture or the words alone would have been able to.
Kian Aluni there on the University of London's Conference on Comics and Medicine. Kian's actually been writing a series of blog posts for us at the Guardian Science blogs. You can read them all at guardian.co.uk/science/blog. That's it for this week. Thanks to Daniel Simons. Check out theinvisiblegorilla.com. Next week, if all goes to plan, we'll be hearing from one of the top people at CERN, who's in charge of the Large Hadron Collider. Just hope their internet's working, and yes, we're aware of the irony there. We've asked them to hurry up with that Higgs boson discovery so that we can give it at least a passing mention in the podcast, so keep your fingers crossed. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, look for Science Weekly. We'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And to be alerted to all of the rest of the Guardian Science content, follow Guardian Science. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth, with thanks also to Kian Aluni. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.